this question of the holy is just always before me, and those holy moments in our lives. And I cannot think of something more holy than what it felt like to be that 5-6-year-old little girl at the side of my bed at night in my footed pajamas, and my grandmother teaching me to pray. The holy presence of God in these moments, so powerful. And I imagine many people can relate to that.
Yolanda Pierce is professor and dean of the Howard University School of Divinity in Washington, D.C. In 2016, she served as founding director of the Center for African American Religious Life at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. She formerly worked at Princeton Theological Seminary. The Reverend Dr. Pierce is the author of a beautiful and poignant book published last year titled In My Grandmother's House, Black Women, Faith, and the Stories We Inherit. We talk today about the morality, sense of identity, and theology she inherited from her religious and familial upbringing, and what she hopes she's leaving behind. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. So, Yolanda Pierce, it is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we're talking this morning over Zoom. The room where we typically record at BYU is being, well, the building's being re-roofed, and they're right now roofing right over the top of that room. So we thought that Zoom would be a better alternative than to hear the banging and the drilling above us. So thank you for talking even through this medium.
I do understand. My entire career has been in higher education. That comes with a lot of construction on college campuses.
That's right. Yeah. So I ask my guests usually how faith figures into their life and work. And you've written this beautiful book full of reflections on this topic. And we'll get into many of these reflections during a conversation. Here at the outset, is there a way that you might summarize how faith informs the work you do and the person you become?
That's a great question. It's a big question as well. I think for me, what I wanted to do was to make sure that the work that I do as a theologian, I'm a womanist theologian by training, that's often work that's done in the academy. It was important to me in this particular project to create a work about theology, about faith, about God, that was accessible to the people who really birthed the faith in me, my grandmother, the church mothers of my denominational tradition. So I think about this question of inheritance, which is why this is about the stories we inherit, to simply suggest that part of who I am, part of what my faith is, it's a beautiful inheritance from the men and women in my life who have gifted me with such strong belief. And so that's kind of what I think about when I think about being a person of faith.
Okay, that's great. You used and then, by the way, all that communicates itself beautifully in the book. You used a phrase there that some of our listeners might not know so well, womanist theologian. Can you explain what a womanist theologian or what womanist theology is?
I'm happy to do so. So womanist theology is a discipline, a field within the academy. In the 1960s or so, there was the blooming of feminist theology, in which women were writing about God, about faith, about belief, writing their theology. There was also, around about the same time, 1960s, early 1970s, an academic field of Black theology, very much so connected to liberation theology coming out of Latin America, Black theology being birthed in the United States. And what was interesting is at this moment, you had Black theology primarily being written by Black men. You had feminist theology primarily being written by white women. And then you didn't have this space, which womanist theology now occupies, in which Black women were writing theology, writing about their experiences, writing about faith. This is important, particularly in the African-American Christian context, in which something like 75 to 85% of the membership of African-American churches are women. And so you have this full flowering of women who are participating in the faith, but they weren't writing theology about it. And so I inherit this wonderful mantle. So womanist theology is the academic study of Black women, faith, theology, God, and how they understand themselves participating in religious life.
What a great description. And by the way, your book is such a great illustration of that theology. I love it. Here's a passage I love from your book. I wonder if you could comment on it. It's about faith. You write this. You write, "My faith, any faith really, is a paradox. We believe what we cannot see. We worship one who cannot be known. We trust in that which is intangible. Our faith requires a nakedness, a vulnerability, and a stripping away of everything until we acknowledge the essence of who we are, creatures who cannot even see 2 minutes into our own future and who desperately need to know we are loved."
Thank you. I love that passage as well. It sounds great coming from you. I think it sounds better than when I actually wrote it. So I'm interested in the vulnerabilities of what it means to be a person of faith, you know, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, that while we have an intellectual reason that we can use to talk about why we believe and what we believe, so much of faith is trust, a trust in who God is, and also a trust in who our brothers and sisters are. And so because of that, it requires you, if you take your faith seriously, to be vulnerable, to share, to express your doubts. And part of why I wanted to write this particular work was to say, as a person of faith, I still have lots of doubts, but God is still loving me, even in the midst of whatever those doubts may be.
I love that. You know, and I am also myself very interested in the vulnerabilities of faith, but I got to say, I'm also terrified by them, right? It's not just a happy experience.
Very scary.
Yeah, it is. I guess I'll ask this question then. How is it that you discern the presence of God in your life? And I guess more specifically, how do you arrive at the conviction that it's with God's help that you make your way forward and not just through your own considerable power and talent or fortune of circumstance?
I used to think about the presence of God as very loud and exuberant. I grew up in the Holiness Pentecostal tradition. And so worship is very bodily and there's lots of music. It's just noisy. It's just no other way to describe it, except it's just sort of very, very noisy, very, very present, very, very bodily. But the older I got, and as I was finding myself in lots of other settings of faith, interfaith settings, settings outside of my own tradition, I was thinking more about how God shows up in the everyday, the ordinary, the just the stuff of life. And so where I'm finding this deep abiding presence of God is not actually for me in the houses of worship, which I attend or even in congregational and ecclesial settings, but it's sometimes just when I'm doing the laundry or when I'm taking a walk or when I'm by myself and I feel the presence of God's love. That's a wonderful, incredible thing, but it also means that there have been seasons in my life where I feel the absence of God as well. And this is the vulnerability piece again, to say that there are wonderful seasons where we feel the richness of God's presence alone or with others. But there are also seasons in which we feel an absence, where we cry to God, "Where are you? I don't feel you. I'm not hearing from you." And to suggest that that is all a part of this walk and this journey of faith. So sometimes still in the exuberance and the very bodily worship, but often in the quiet, still places, and acknowledging that sometimes when that absence is felt by me, it doesn't mean that God is not there. It just means it is a season that I need to go through in order to listen more attentively to God's voice. That's special, but it's also very, very hard when you are in the midst of that season.
I think that's really insightful, Yolanda. I think that's really, really good. That really resonates with me. I find too, I don't, do you ever sense this? That once in a while, if I have large questions, or I've been going through some kind of personal crisis, I will sense that God is present. But because God is present does not mean that God's providing all the answers that I desire. So God can be both present and silent simultaneously. And I find that to be sometimes an enigmatic sense of both reassurance, but also enduring questioning that's not suspended by the sheer fact that I believe that God is present, that God sees.
I love that, because the two things that I think I come to again and again, themes in this particular book and other books I've written in my other work, is the sense of tension and the sense of contradiction. The tensions of our faith, a God we know to be present, and yet sometimes we feel the absent. The contradictions of being a person of faith and yet having doubts and the unbelief. And so the idea of contradictions and tensions really animate this work. And I wanted to present that as my own act of vulnerability, but also as an accessible way for people to enter in. The question I began with was, what if my grandmother was the greatest theologian I've ever known? And so for me, as someone trained in the academy, trained as a scholar who's read, you know, the world's greatest theologians in a very formal academic way, it was to say, what if the greatest theologian I've ever known was this older Black woman from the rural South who raised me, she and my grandfather, in the faith, to say that I believe God wants us to know who God is in the most accessible, ordinary, regular, and most intimate of ways.
That's such a beautiful thought. I love the thought that your grandmother might be the most profound theologian you've ever known. And that kind of thing really rings true. I don't have your upbringing and background, obviously, but in my own faith tradition, a lot of those people who have most moved me or opened my mind to the things of God have been those people who are closest to me, who live otherwise ordinary lives. There's nothing outwardly exceptional, but the people they are, there's something deeply exceptional about them as individuals. And you can tell that they really understand deeply the things of God through their own lived experience. That communicates in a way more powerful than many a sermon.
Absolutely. I recall the image of my grandmother teaching me to pray as, you know, a little kid, as parents and grandparents do, and kneeling beside my tiny little twin bed. And she would kneel with me and you know, we would clasp our hands and she would teach me to pray. She would teach me the Lord's Prayer. She would teach. And I think about that as a moment in which I really began to understand the faith that I was inheriting through her, but how wonderful, how powerful, how holy. This question of the holy is just always before me, and those holy moments in our lives. And I cannot think of something more holy than what it felt like to be that 5-6-year-old little girl at the side of my bed at night in my footed pajamas, and my grandmother teaching me to pray. The holy presence of God in these moments, so powerful. And I imagine many people can relate to that. And so this is what I mean about accessibility, that people hopefully are reading this and thinking about those all little small moments, but holy moments with parents or grandparents or a loved one or with a child. What is the holy? What is the sacred? And so I hope those are some of the questions that we think as we read what I hope this is, which is a work of theology.
Great. That's beautiful. Thank you. So let me ask you then about the readership of the book. Do you see yourself writing for people whose childhood experience is somewhat like your own? Do you see yourself giving expression to things held in common? Or is it for readers like me from different backgrounds? Or did you write it for yourself to help make sense of your own experience?
Sure. all of those, right?
Yeah, right.
So it is. It's the whosoever will. I was not planning to write for readers with a background like my own. It's a very sort of kind of narrow background. Everyone's experience is their own. Like I said, a Black woman, little Black girl growing up in Holiness Pentecostal Church in Brooklyn, New York. It's just so, so very particular. But what I was hoping, and this is my sincere hope, is that anyone could read and think about some of the most profound experiences in their own life, but also think about how theology is taught and received. And so the theologian in me, even though I was writing something very accessible, still needed to talk about theology. So one chapter is about soteriology, which is of course the theology about salvation. One chapter is about ecclesiology, which is the church. One chapter is about eschatology. I didn't name those chapters, right? This is the eschatological chapter, or this is the soteriological chapter, but I had that in mind. And so I hope it would be anyone who is thinking through questions of faith, but also who wants to take that seriously, as I took it very seriously, even though these are very personal and intimate stories, but they are in my mind grounded around certain kinds of systems of theology that influence my academic work.
That's great. And you know, which I love how you described that, because it's true. I see in there the soteriology and the ecclesiology and the eschatology. I see it, but it's but it's so beautifully layered into your own experience and how you describe it, that it's really elegantly done. So I guess that raises this question for me. Could you have written this book 10 years ago? I mean, no. Would you have been ready to write it? Or would the historical moment been right for a book like this? Or is this really a book of its moment?
I could not have written this 10 years ago, because in a sense, I think that part of the process of an academic who writes a book for a more popular audience is her trust that she can do that at this point in her career. I've been in higher education my entire career. I've had a very traditional academic path from assistant professor to associate professor to full professor. Now I'm a dean. I don't know how that happened, but here we are. At the beginning of my career, you don't take certain risks. You write in ways that you are taught to write when you are a scholar, when you are in a doctoral program. You understand your audience to be other scholars who will critique your work and who will respond to your work. And that has its place and that has its value. So 10 years ago, that was my priority. I think now to be in this place is very different for me. I care very much so about doing that and training my PhD students to do that as well. But I also want to leave a legacy. I also want to, it's an expression we use in my tradition, bless my origins. My origins is this small, tiny storefront church in Brooklyn, New York. And so I live in that tension, writing and speaking for a popular audience and still doing my academic work. 10 years ago, I don't think I was courageous enough to say I can do both. Now I say, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. And it's wonderful and freeing.
Yeah, well, that's the blessing of having the kind of really kind of gravitas you've acquired, right, through your writing, your career, which has been very distinguished. I've got to say, though, as an academic, does it ever strike you as enigmatic? Because what you said really rings true with me. It's you know, that one does not take certain risks early on. But academia, it's an elevated but also a narrow profession. It's under some sort of crisis, seems to me, in lots of ways. Does it strike you as enigmatic that we're training ourselves and others not to take risks when it seems in some respects that risks right now are what is most needed?
Absolutely. And that's, again, the contradiction. We need risk takers. We need people doing ordinary things, extraordinary things, things we've never seen before. Particularly, I want to argue in with the study of religion, historically or theologically, but I've been in the study of religion. Part of what we see socially, politically, in our nation and certainly throughout the world is very much so connected to religion. And I am often amazed at ignorance around religion, around people of different faiths, around world religions, around how much faith and belief and religion impact who we are, how we vote, what we do, what we do. And so it seems to me we need people willing to be courageous to talk about this in public spaces, private spaces, to do different kinds of scholarships than sort of the kind of the traditional peer-reviewed, I'll write for this journal kind of scholarship, because I think we so profoundly need people who are cognizant, aware, understand, are willing to engage, are willing to take some risk so that we can have the kinds of conversations to be the kinds of global citizens we need to be. So on one hand, it's just crazy to me that we don't want the PhD academic route, scholarly route to change, and yet it must change because our world has so profoundly changed. And then there are plenty of us, I think, living in the contradictions of that. I imagine the younger scholar, you know, new to the tenure track, who must make some choices. And but I also wonder if we're bold enough to think more, more transformative education in higher education. And that's another whole other conversation I think we definitely could have.
Amen to what you just said. That was great. I find that very invigorating, that point of view. And you're in addition, Yolanda, to make that case. So you're a good spokesperson for this. So thank you for that. Let me ask you about some passages from the book. It's a beautiful book. I'm just going to pick out a small handful of favorites. We could spend the next 18 hours talking about the entire book. Let me start here. Right, page one, you write, "In my grandmother's house, Jesus was a Black man." And you describe the gift this Black Jesus was to you. Can you elaborate on what that gift was and why it was a gift?
So I had all of these images growing up in my family's household of Black Jesus, a dark-skinned Jesus, the crown of thorns. Sometimes Jesus had, you know, locks. Sometimes Jesus had very, very curly hair. Now, growing up, it's just what you see, so you don't ever think about it. It's only reflecting back. I am so grateful for that. It is a culture, American culture in particular, in which blonde hair, blue-eyed, six-pack Jesus is ubiquitous. It is a culture in which I remember getting a little Precious Moments Bible, and it had little glossy pictures in the middle of it, and it was blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus holding the lamb. And I'm so grateful to my grandparents who, with these images that were around our house, they were teaching me something that, as a theologian, I have words to describe. It's the Imago Dei, the idea that we are made in God's image and God's likeness. And I got that very, very early. I didn't have to retrain myself. I didn't have to learn that anew by surrounding me with this idea that Jesus looked like me. My grandparents weren't educated. They weren't trying to make any political statement. They weren't even trying to make a statement about sort of where Jesus was from. I think they were just trying to say, this is God and you belong to God. And I don't know if there's a way to adequately thank my grandparents, my grandmother in particular, for that. It countered all of the later sort of white supremacist views and ideology about the person of Jesus that I would later encounter.
Yeah, I think that lesson that your grandmother bequeathed you about, you know, this is God, you belong to God, that is so profound. And the notion we're created in the image of God, I think, is obscured by a lot of the ways we represent God, as being merely the projection of our own, often in this country, you know, racial past and ideals. And I think what you just said is so profound. Let me ask you about prayer. I love a passage that you write about prayer. I think this is beautiful. It's still early in the book. You write, "Prayer is a contradiction. One may feel profoundly alone in the moment of prayer, but when you enter before the throne of grace, the divine is present. Prayer is a petition, the acknowledgement of weakness, that in our own strength and power, we are insufficient for the burdens we face. Prayer is intercession. It is the act of standing in the cosmic gap for others, a reminder that somewhere, somebody is calling your name before God. Prayer is also a celebration. It is gratitude for what God has done, large and small, known and unknown." It's such a great passage. These contradictions, prayer is contradiction, petition, intercession, celebration. Can you comment on that?
I think I was, I'm really struck sometimes about how so many contemporary conversations about prayer assumes that God is sort of a divine ATM, which is to say, we pray for something and then we expect it to happen. Or, you know, sort of we insert the ATM card, which is the prayer, and then we expect something to come out of the machine. And I think to myself, it's a very transactional view of prayer that we sort of just imbibe. It's just all around us, right? If you pray, then there is this result. If you pray, then God will bless you with thing, tangible thing, intangible thing. I want to challenge that. And a part of what I want to do is to talk about prayer as sort of conversation with a friend, a beloved friend, which is to say, when you have a conversation with someone you love, particularly if it's someone you haven't spoken to in a while, it's not a transaction. It is the, tell me what you've been doing. What have you been up to? Oh, let me tell you about what I've been up to. And it's just full of love and life. So how do we get past prayer as transactional and get to a place of prayer as holy conversation, as listening and not just speaking, as yes, petitions. Clearly we have things, we need things and we want to be blessed. But that can't be the substance of it. I was raised in a tradition in which people would tarry. So the idea of tarry within the African-American tradition is that the service would start 7, 8 p.m. at night and they would pray all the way through until the next morning. As a little kid, you're allowed at some point to fall asleep. I just thought to myself, these folks are just, what are we doing here? But I now sort of have a better perspective of it, which is, it wasn't 12 hours of, please give me these things that I lack. It was hours of conversation and expression and petition, surely. And I just thought, we've got to think more comprehensively what it means to pray, especially if we think that prayer is at the center of our faith tradition. God is not an ATM, and we can't only go to prayer and expect something. And sometimes we don't even say thank you.
That is great. I'm so grateful to hear you articulate that. You sort of non-transactional, much more nuanced, layered understanding of prayer. I think that's fantastic. You know, if I were adding to your list, and you could add to that list.
Oh, you keep adding. Things, yes, you know, please.
Yeah, you know, you could add to it endless. But if I were adding to it, I'd say it's sometimes prayer is communion. It's just a chance to connect with God and feel that God is present, even in times of difficulty, when you don't get what you want. Sometimes for me, prayer is a painful process of reckoning with what is true. It's like being called to account for mistaken ideas or wrong ways of being in the world or ways I've overlooked people, mistreated people. Prayer can be just a reassurance of love. There are, and none of these things are transactional and none of them are easy. I mean, they all require some kind of process of adjustment on our part to come to terms with. And I think that's so important what you articulate. I love it.
Thank you.
Here's another passage from the book that I thought was really insightful and really poignant. You describe an experience you had in college learning about Margaret Garner and about a classmate of yours who understood the story of Margaret Garner very differently from you. And you observe that on the one hand, as you put it, Our shared Christian background seemed to close the gap between our very different circumstances. And yet, on the other, you realize that, again, in your words, the God you believed in and served was not the same God in whom your classmate believed. So I guess I'm wondering, could you share with us the story both of Margaret Garner and of your realization as a college student about what that moment in class sort of did for you?
Thank you. So Margaret Garner was an enslaved woman in Ohio, and she managed to escape from slavery with her children. And so was a fugitive slave for a number of weeks and was eventually caught and was going to be put to death or remanded back to the person who owned her, and made a choice to actually kill one of her children so that her child would not be sent back to slavery. And there was a trial in which she was tried, very unusual in the 19th century for there to be a trial. And so she was tried for this, this act of killing her child. Toni Morrison writes the novel Beloved, in part based on Margaret Garner. So obviously a fictional account, a beautiful, creative account. It's one of my favorite novels. But for me, the point was I was sitting in this classroom with a young white man. He raised like I was in the Christian faith. We had spoken lots of times before. We shared a vocabulary. When you come from a Christian tradition, you have a shared vocabulary. And so in some ways we bonded quickly, as you know, preacher's kids often do. But when we got to this story, the real story and then the fictional story we were reading, I realized that we were living in such very different worlds. I was thinking about Margaret Garner's pain. I was thinking about the horrible choice that she had to make. I was thinking about a woman who truly believed that there were some fates worse than life, so than death. She had been raped by her slaveholder. She feared the same for her daughter. And my classmate simply had a very, to me, simplistic understanding of the situation. She was wrong. She shouldn't have done what she did. She should have submitted to the authorities. She should have let her children be sold away from her. And we just went kind of back and forth in that classroom. I was mystified that he couldn't understand me. And he was mystified that as a person of faith, as a person claiming to be a Christian, how could I not condemn this act? And it just really was an eye-opening experience for me that we can share the same vocabulary, we can even share some of the same beliefs, but that who we are and how we have to move through the world really colors our understandings, morals, our ethics. Moving through the world as a Black woman, as a descendant of enslaved people, I really understood that story very, very differently than he did. And so it sent me on a path in which I'm still on to think about how race and gender and privilege and circumstances impact how we understand who God is.
It's such it's an incredibly powerful part of your book, I thought, you know, because you really do capture that. So it's a story layered upon a story. You have this unthinkably tragic story of Margaret Garner. I mean, the choice she faced and the decision she reached, trying to get into the mind of where that's the decision you'd want to make. It's just, it's unspeakably tragic. But then you layer that, you know, into your own experience. I thought it was just so beautifully captured and poignantly, just heart-wrenchingly. And it seems to speak to the real issue that, yeah, we may share a lot of belief, but we do not share the context for that belief. We do not therefore share the same conclusions that we arrive at least initially from those beliefs. And there's a lot of work, a lot of space we need to sort of close to really come to a place where we understand each other. I thought that was beautifully done in your book, Yolanda.
Thank you. I think that's exactly, you hit on it. There's a gap, and there always will be a gap, and that's okay, how we understand each other. It is it is the thing, though, that helped me, I think, to embark on a career in which I decided I needed to be one of the people responsible for how we can understand one another a little better. But it was, that's the language. It was this gap between us that may never be fully closed. I think we can come close, though. So it was actually a very hard thing to write about. I didn't want to demonize this young man in my class, right? Because his experiences are his experiences. His beliefs are his beliefs. So there's room for us to disagree without demonizing one another. But there was also, for me, the desire to say how we understand faith, how we understand God, how we understand theology is, of course, it's embedded in how we walk through this world, our bodies, our situations, our circumstances, our racial identities, our gender. And so we might come to some different conclusions, and that's okay. We have to be willing to talk about that.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And thank you for talking about it so well. Another passage I loved in your book. There are so many. I've only got time for a few more, but here's one. You write, I think, really, really beautifully about the challenges faced by Black women. I mean, here's the pet book. I'm quoting you now. Some Black women, after earning the highest degrees offered by the academy, leave spaces of power and privilege, choosing not to work in the toxic soup of higher education, and discover that the nonprofit and social justice agency worlds they've chosen come along with all the same hierarchies and racism. Some Black women leave the church after finding little sanctuary, but plenty of misogyny and patriarchy, only to find that their self-help books and yoga classes and meditation techniques fail to fill a deep spiritual void. Some Black women leave unhealthy relationships, breaking away from those who try to diminish them, those who try to dim their shine, only to find a life of loneliness, all the challenges of Black marriage demographics, and the possibility they may never meet a life partner. My question, you know, I asked this to someone who is a dean, who's really, by all accounts, very successful. Have you faced these contradictions yourself, and have you managed to reconcile them? And if not, how do you deal with them?
Thank you. It's a great question. And the answer is absolutely yes. I'm just writing out of my own experience. I think for me, the big question is the question of leaving and staying, right? And thinking through that more comprehensively, the answer is complicated. Sometimes you leave, sometimes you stay, right? But I was just hearing, I hear from my own students, I hear from friends and colleagues that they're often having to make very difficult choices about whether to stay in a church setting, whether to stay in a marriage, whether to stay at a particular job, or whether to go. And we want to respond, I think, you know, out of our love for that person, with a very quick, oh, you should go. Oh, that's just, it's a terrible place and you should go. Oh, church is patriarchal, you have to leave. Or we say, oh, well, you can stay and you can work. And to say, whatever you do, it is complicated. I know women who have left higher education. Higher education is a very, very difficult space sometimes for women. Some have thrived and succeeded, and others have not and regret their choice. And so why do we not talk about how difficult it is to make choices? It, for me, was fundamentally about making a choice at one point in my life about whether to leave the church, whether to leave the Christian tradition. And so all of these other experiences, I think, are connected to a choice that I simply had to make one day about the misogyny I was encountering, the patriarchy that I was encountering, the racism that I was encountering, my engagement with sort of like white supremacist practices in Christian spaces I was encountering, and to say, perhaps it's better for me to be in another space, a different space outside of this space. And me hearing God tell me, I need you to remain. But my choice is not everyone's choice. We're going to need critics and prophets who stand outside of the gate And we're going to need some people who will stay and love, but do it with critique. But it's hard. And so I wanted to speak to the folks who I know might be needing to make that choice. Our LGBT brothers and sisters, whether they stay in their churches or whether they leave their denominations, there are just so many choices that people are faced with connected to their faith. And I didn't want to downplay how hard it is to make those choices. I'm using Black women's experiences as a framework to talk about that because those are the ones that I know best. But I think it's larger. Do you stay or do you go? And that's a profoundly important question in this particular day and age, I think, when it comes to religion.
Oh, it sure is. And that is such a fantastically nuanced answer. It seems just right to me to capture the complexity of these kinds of issues. And we do need people, you know, across who make different choices and who bear, therefore, a different kind of witness. I will say I'm grateful that you stayed in academia because I think there's a lot of good to be done in academia. I think you can do a lot of good. And I am thrilled that we can talk today in this way and from inside the academy, though I certainly understand those who leave and justifiably so in many cases.
Absolutely.
One more passage from the book. And then I wish we had double the time that we have. But this one, you conclude the book by remarking how it's a powerful worship experience to simply sit with death and all of the various representations of death, doubt, fear, loneliness, disbelief, and weariness. Why do you describe these experiences and feelings as representations of death? And what's powerful, even worshipful, about sitting with them?
It was, I had a long conversation with my editor when I was writing the book, and she was like, you know, this last chapter seems very solemn. Do you want to write something that leaves the reader with kind of a more upbeat note? Because I'm really, in real life, I want your listeners to know I am just like the happiest person in the world. I really am just full of the joy of the Lord. But it ends, as you know, on a very somber note. And I spent some time thinking about it because I did understand the question that was really being posed to me by ending and talking about death and loneliness and the sitting with death. It's just it's a downer. But ultimately, that is where I end. And this is the chapter about eschatology. One of the few, and there are maybe, you know, a handful, but one of the few common human experiences across age, race, gender, is that people die and we grieve. And how we do that and how we don't do that sometimes is such a common human experience that unites us in powerful ways. And so I didn't want to just kind of end on a sort of happy note and say, well, you know, God is good and things, and God is good. But I wanted to remind us of the frailties of human life, our finite time that we have on this earth. For those of us who believe in a hope for a life after this one, but to also deal with the realities of grief and loneliness, because I do think it is one of the few things across every spectrum in which someone can relate to and their heart may be open to. So we sit with death. We're called for Christians biblically to think about death, to think about the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, but more than that, to think about the between time, between the cross and between the empty tomb. And I just simply wanted to say to my reader, don't rush just to the celebration of the empty tomb and he is risen, which is a beautiful, beautiful part of our faith. But the between time, where there's a lot of uncertainty and loneliness and grief and despair, and to know that God is also there and present in that place. So I write a little bit about grief, and I've been writing a little bit more about grief. So you might see some new stuff coming from me about this act of grief, but that was important for me to say, this is what we share as humans. And maybe this is a point of connection for all of us across all of our differences.
You know, so much of our conversation today has been about these nuances, right? The subtleties of our experience, spiritual and just human everyday experience. And I really appreciated that the way you ended that book, because it does give voice to precisely those kinds of things in our collective humanity. As individuals, maybe we do face these kinds of ambiguities, difficulties, challenges. I thought it was a great way to end the book. Let me end the interview by asking one more question here. So you've written a book. It's a work of theology. In some ways, it's also a memoir, and it's a beautiful one. I've got to ask you, was it cathartic at all to write? And if it was, where do you go from here as a writer? I've written a memoir of my own, and this is a question I'm asking myself, well, now what? So,
thank you. It's a great question. Where do I go as a writer? So I will say, I don't think of it as a memoir. I think of it just as a collection of essays. I lead a very, very boring life. And I think people write memoirs who've had very interesting lives. I basically do laundry and work all the time. So I don't know. But where to go as a writer? So as I mentioned, I'm just in always those between spaces. I just finished up an academic project that is about theology and poetry. My training, I have a PhD in religion and literature, but I am also writing another, what I hope to be very popular, accessible book that is about an embodied theology. And so I think that I will just try to spend the rest of my career in those spaces, you know, continuing to write sort of more formal, traditional work for the academy, but also writing for my grandmother, right? So in my tradition, we have church mothers. The church mothers are elder women in the church, 65, 70, whatever age they are. Just at some point, you become a church mother. I don't know who decides. It's not an age set or anything. At some point, we just decide you're a church mother and we call you Mother Johnson or Mother Jones or whatever your name is. And I want to write for them. And so I think whatever is next, it is a reminder to me that there are church mothers like my grandmother, like Mother Johnson and Mother Jones, for whom I am accountable. And I always want to bless the spaces that they have helped me, the levels they've helped me to achieve through their prayers and encouragement.
I can't wait to read those books. I think that your life is very interesting.
Thanks. Thanks. I don't know. A lot of paperwork, but thank you. I appreciate that.
Right. Yeah. Maybe your life as a dean is not as interesting, but everything else is. Yeah. I've got to say, this has been so great to talk with you. I've also got to give a shout out here to Abby Thatcher, the center intern. She found this book and turned me to it. Huge thanks to Abby. And Yolanda, I cannot thank you enough for coming on here and talking with me. It's a wonderful book. This has been a great conversation, and I look forward to talking with you again.
It's been a pleasure and a joy. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.